Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
Views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Do you think that your soul is considered a biometric? Because once you lose that, you're in real trouble.
I'm just waiting for ear prints. You can really do that joke with any body part.
All right. So the first article we're talking about is Microsoft makes a bold move towards a passwordless future. And this comes to us from actually the Malwarebytes blog.
Just funny. I guess we could have gone and found the actual announcement on Microsoft.com, but we didn't do that. Nah.
Actually, it's funny. I didn't even think about looking at Microsoft's site for that. Neither. I guess it just shows you how much value subconsciously we place on what comes from Microsoft's marketing team.
Dang.
But the quote from the article, in a recent blog, Microsoft announced as of September 15th, 2021, you can completely remove the password from your Microsoft account and use the Microsoft Authenticator app, Windows Hello, a security key, or a verification code sent to your phone or email to sign into Microsoft apps and services. And also within this blog post, Malwarebytes interviewed Per Thorsheim, who runs PasswordsCon, on the subject of removing passwords.
That's interesting. I didn't know there was a whole conference on passwords, but I guess that shouldn't really surprise me.
I didn't either. In the interview, he actually says it's on passwords and authentication. So it's just not passwords per se, but more around the concept of authentication and changes in how that works. So I'm sure they talk about FIDO and other things as well at the conference. But since it's in Sweden, It's not likely that I'm going to get there anytime soon.
Probably not.
Although, if someone wanted to buy me a ticket, I wouldn't say no.
There's that point. Like, it's a professional conference. Maybe you can get the company to pay for it. You should be, what was that conference in AlohaCon in Hawaii? I can never get a company to go for that one.
Why are they so suspicious?
Vegas is hard enough.
So users should think this is awesome, right? Supposedly, no one likes passwords. At least that's what I keep hearing. Which I'm skeptical about that. I think that's rather a misnomer that people don't like passwords. Because everyone's familiar with passwords now. They're comfortable with the concept of passwords. What they don't like is the rules around passwords and the fact you have to change passwords all the time.
Yeah. And trying to remember all the different passwords. I think a lot of the people that don't like passwords probably just aren't using password managers yet.
I'm sure they're not. Otherwise, I don't even think about passwords anymore because I use password manager.
Very much so.
So I think rather than getting better passwords, it would be just as beneficial. Maybe not just as beneficial, but it would be extremely beneficial to educate people on password managers and actually get an enterprise password manager for your company that you're working at.
I'd say one of the best investments I ever made was getting a password manager. It just allows it all. Occasionally there's weird things where some websites don't work correctly with it. I've definitely run into websites where they do something to the field that prevents you from copying and pasting into the field, which I don't understand at all. I don't see how that makes you any more secure.
Yep. Yeah, no, exactly. And I'm unsure exactly what their thoughts are on that. I bought the pro version just because I thought it had additional features or whatever at the time when I bought it. But it was less than 50 cents a month or less than $1 a month because of the discount I was able to get with it. It's pretty nice. And there are a lot of free ones out there like Bitwarden and others that are well-designed and everything that you don't actually have to pay anything for.
Even the ones that are built into the browsers are better than nothing. I know that they're considered to be less secure than LastPass and other ones, but still, it's better than putting a 6-digit all numeric code.
Because if you've authenticated the machine and had the browser open, then you know your password manager is open, where you have access to the passwords in the browser. But it's one of those things, it's just trade-off, just like anything else. But anyway, if they get rid of the password, they're not really, you still have to have something in order to prove who you are to authenticate to the system. So really what they're doing is they're shifting the target away from attackers trying to get passwords to attackers attacking this system that they're replacing with the password. And this is part of Microsoft's shift from what they call basic authentication to modern authentication, which basic authentication is just the username and password. But the modern authentication is actually a category of several different protocols, which execute differently, but they all really rely on token-based claims. The user may provide a username or password depending on the scenario, but what they get is a token. And some examples of this are like SAML or OAuth.
So what's interesting about this is it actually sounds like what I've been looking into for zero trust networks, where they talk about where it's not just a user signs into a resource and they get access to it. It's also how's user acting? Are they coming from their normal place? Are they reaching out to their normal services? Are they sending the normal number of requests? Are they typing in the same way? Like all the other, there's been lots and lots of concepts for authentication that have been pushed around, but it'd be really interesting to see all of them combined. Like I remember seeing one a couple of years ago that talked about like how you type on the keyboard as your authentication because everybody types uniquely.
I actually think using multiple data points together would be valuable. It's moving from single event-based alerting to risk-based
correlation.
Alerting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So if you have 10 different indicators of who you are, and 9 of those or 8 of those are
trusted.
Well, 8 of those indicate that it is you versus yeah. 2 of those.
Oh,
fail.
I see.
2 of those fail or whatever, then it'll let you in versus 7 of those fail and only 3 pass, then it's not going to let you in.
Gotcha. Yeah, because you could do pretty easily. Where are they logging in from? Are they logging in from their home network? I know that a lot of websites will do that, where if you're logging in from the same network, you just get right back in. You could do biometrics like face, since pretty much every laptop and every phone has a face thing now. You could do a password or a PIN if you wanted to. You could do like the typing identification. You could do time-based as well. What times do you normally log in from? All those are pretty easy to do remotely. So any that I'm thinking of that you could have people put in a smart card or use a thumbprint or something. You probably have to do that for the first couple of months until you got patterns for the rest of them.
Right. But I've talked to one provider before where you'd actually use multiple authentication methods together or multiple identity methods together. So you'd log into the site with username and password, and maybe 2-factor. But depending on what action you want to take once you are logged in, then you may or may not be prompted for a different type of authentication. Maybe 2-factor token, maybe a fingerprint, something like that, depending on what the transaction is.
And that makes sense. Like you said, if you set a threshold, like 7 out of 10 items agree, you're good, but 6 out of 10 items, put in your PIN or plug in your YubiKey or something like that.
Right. So maybe you don't necessarily deny them, but you add another gate, because then that raises the bar for what the attacker has to know or has to be able to accommodate in order to compromise that person's account or whatever it is they're trying to get into.
Actually, there have been some of those identity faced verification ones. If you ever log in to do your free credit report or freeze your credit, and it asks you information off your credit report, and I always scramble for those. It's like, what date did you live in this house? What address did you live in? I'm like, shoot, where did I... So some of those are pretty.
Some of those are weird too, because I had one where they said, you have this account with us. What kind of account is it? And I said, it's almost like having to know the factory, the industry terms or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, it's a line of credit. And they're like, that is also known as what?
It's like a line of credit.
Just, I don't know. You're going to have to give me a hint. But
so I did see they are providing options. They're providing the Microsoft Authenticator app, which seems fine. I've used it. It's fine. Windows Hello, that one's interesting. That's, I had to look that up, what exactly that was. It's the sign in to Windows 10 devices with a pen. So a pen is not terribly secure, but I imagine in combination with having, I guess they'd have to sign into your Microsoft account from another Windows 10 device. But how do you do that if Windows Hello is your method of getting in? You have to have a second. You have to have another one. The YubiKey security key. Well, they mentioned a security key. They mentioned YubiKey. That one seems like that one's pretty secure, although that's a problem if you lose it. And then finally, they mentioned verification code sent to your phone or email, which if it's text messages or email, like now if your email or phone are compromised, like they can just go and get access to your Microsoft account.
Well, access to your email has always been very dangerous anyway, because password resets go there, verifications codes go there. So if you lose access to your email, you're in a lot of trouble anyway.
Yeah. That's fair.
And of course, SMS has its own batch of problems with SIM swapping and all that as well.
Yeah, although frankly, that seems like that's a lot more work than the email side. I'm less worried about that. That one seems to make sense more for highly targeted attacks.
And I heard a good suggestion recently that says for the SMS stuff, you should probably use something like Google Voice, which the SIM swap attacks can't work on. But Thorstrom's main concern about this whole thing is how users recover their account if they lose their form of authentication, whatever that may be. And there are attackers now that are already, they don't attack your account directly. They attack the recovery mechanisms for your account. There was a study or a exercise, if you will, that some researchers did a while ago that indicated that actually your voicemail could be targeted for this, because voicemail is usually protected by a 4-digit PIN. So they attack your account, ask for a password reset to be set to your phone number, and then they attack your voice. They have that get sent to your voicemail, and then they attack the voicemail with a 4-digit PIN because it's only 4 digits.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But to his point, though, if you forget your password, you can get your password reset. But what happens if you lose your token, like you were talking about a second ago with the YubiKey? Then what do you do?
Yeah, because if the, like you're saying, if the reset is just send it to your email again, then that doesn't seem any more secure, really. Although it is easier for the user if all they have to type in is a pen or something. Maybe that's the thing, is it's the same level of security as what we have, but it's less painful for the user.
And actually, I heard a joke recently that apparently this was said that this individual was not keeping track of any of their passwords.
Whenever they reset it everywhere.
That's all they would do, is ask for a password reset whenever they needed to authenticate.
Wow.
Which is crazy. I don't know how they came up with that idea, but that's scary.
So their password is basically just their email address. They have a username and then access to the password.
Huh. Right.
That's interesting. I've been seeing a lot more people that are actually doing something like that, where when you log in, you put in your user account and it just sends you an email. It's like, click on the email to sign in. I don't know when that started, but sometime in the last 6 months or so, I've been noticing a lot of sites or applications doing that.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah, and I've been seeing a lot of applications. I think two of them. I'm trying Descript, which is a new editing tool for podcasts that's supposed to be faster. They, when you start up their app, it actually kicks you over to their website where you sign in on the website, and then it kicks you back over to the app. And Adobe does that too.
Oh, that's like Plex does that. And actually, I was using years ago, a remote desktop tool for Mac systems called Splashtop, which worked in a similar way as well.
Interesting. All right, but we're going to have to talk about that.
But we were talking about a minute ago about how people feel about passwords. And there's a lot of inertia behind the use of passwords. At this point, everybody knows how to use the username and password. It's not new to them. And a lot of people fear change or the unknown. And I think the fact that Microsoft is doing this, and as large as Microsoft is, that actually is going to put some inertia is actually going to maybe be able to overcome some of that inertia to get people to think differently about authentication. And maybe even if this is not necessarily the right way to do it or isn't necessarily successful, maybe it will lead down the road to people changing or thinking differently about authentication. So we can do something better than usernames and passwords. And of course, this is relevant or this matters because passwords are everywhere. I'd say I can't even count probably the number of usernames and passwords that I currently have in my password manager.
I did. It was literally like 70 or 80 passwords. It was utterly and completely ridiculous.
Oh, I know I have over 100.
Whew. Stop signing up for sites.
Hey, how do I get, how am I going to get the Nigerian prince money if I don't have all these counts?
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
But anyway, what you should do about it is at least start using the password manager now, regardless of whether you're using Microsoft or not. And for your password manager, it would make sense for you to, number one, ensure that you have two-factor authentication set up for it and write down your master password. And what I would suggest on top of that is with your two-factor authentication, print out the QR code for that two-factor authentication as well. And maybe not keep it necessarily with your written down password, but they both should be in a fireproof container of some sort. Because if you lose your smartphone that's got your Google Authenticator or Microsoft Authenticator app on it, then you've lost your two-factor authentication as well. So make sure you have both of those things on paper.
Yeah, because a lot of people are like, oh, don't write down your passwords. Don't write down your passwords. And I'd say that's very correct at work. But when you're at home, like, what's your threat model? Is the person that's the thief breaking into your home is also going to steal your passwords? They might if you leave them out and you like put like in big red letters, bank account password on top of it. But if you, like you were saying, stick in a fireproof safe or something, write down your master password in case you forget it, then the chances are almost nil that someone's going to come in, steal your master password, and then go plunder your online accounts, at least not this decade.
Right. Everything's a trade-off. You got to consider what's the greater risk, that someone's going to break into your house, steal your master password to your password vault, or that you're going to forget the password. You know, what's the greater risk? And in my opinion, it's quite obvious which one. So Steve Gibson, for everyone may or may not be familiar with him, he's someone who's been doing the security business for a long time. And about 7 years ago, he came up with this concept called SQRL, which is simple, quick, reliable logon. And there'll be a link in the show notes to a 2.5 hour long video where he explains how SQRL works. The short explanation of it is, and this is an entirely different way to authenticate. You don't even have a username or a password to use SQRL. If you want to get the full understanding of it, obviously watch that video. The kind of gist of it is that you give each site your public key, and then they will use your public key to sign something, which you will then decrypt with your private key, which gives them the indicator that you are who you say you are and authenticates you into the system. So that's the very short answer to it. If you want to fully understand it, though, watch that 2.5 hour long video. And in that video, you hear that joke about what I would consider a joke about the person who doesn't remember any of their passwords. But I think Steve's concept there is a really good one and is probably the way the industry should move based on my understanding of it. And if you go to the link in the show notes, it's not only going to have that video on there. There are a couple other videos on there, but there are also 3 or 4 white papers that also detail how SQRL works and some of the intricacies of that concept. So I'm a pretty big fan of the idea. I have not really seen it adopted anywhere that's useful for myself. But one of the challenges with Steve's concept, though, is you would be fully responsible for ensuring you don't lose your credentials. Because if you mess it up and forget your credentials, that is it. There is no recovery mechanism that someone else is going to help you out with. Now, the protocol and the design for the system has methods for you to do your own backup and recovery to ensure that you don't have that problem. But if you fail to follow those processes and those steps and configure it properly, and you do forget your authentication, that's it. That's game over for whatever account you're trying to get into.
That's no bueno.
For a lot of people, it will be because they have no confidence in themselves or in their ability to use technology. But it goes along the lines of what you and I were talking about a little bit ago, because we're in the same boat already with our password managers. Because yeah. I have no idea what my passwords are. If I wanted to memorize them, I couldn't because they're, 20, 30 characters long, full of random junk. So you and I are already in that boat. And you take those precautions of writing down your master password and printing out the QR code in order as your own personal backup to ensure that you don't fall victim to that same type of scenario. So it's not much different than that. But because the concept is different, people will be very fearful of that, like we were talking about earlier. People know passwords, usernames and passwords. So deviating from that is going to make people afraid. And it's going to take a lot of work to get over that inertia and that fear.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I don't think the passwords are going away. I think the people are going to stick with them forever.
I don't know. Like I said, I think Steve's idea is a good one. And maybe eventually over time it'll get adopted, but it's not probably going to be in our lifetime.
Fair enough. All right. Are you done with passwords?
I'm totally done with passwords. I've had it with them. I'm going to go passwordless.
I'm going passwordless. I'll use my thumbprint on everything. Cashier's going to ask me, how am I going to pay? I'm going to stick my thumb right on her forehead and be like,
going password commando.
Yikes. All right. So U.S. crypto, the next article is from CSO Online. It is about U.S. cryptocurrency exchange sanctions over ransomware, likely not the last. That's awkward. I thought it was a U.S. cryptocurrency exchange. I was like, wait a second. The article is not about a U.S. one. It's about a Russian one. The wording was a little off. But I see it's the U.S. sanctions, not the U.S. cryptocurrency
exchange. It's about a Czechoslovakian exchange.
That's owned by Russian nationals.
Owned by a Russian.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so the U.S., what happened is the U.S. placed a cryptocurrency exchange on the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, sanctioned entity list, the Specially Designated Nationals and Blocked Persons list, otherwise known as the SDN. I don't know why they don't add the VP on there, but SDN. Maybe that's too many letters. So this exchange, SUEX, as David just said, is Czechoslovakian, but it's owned by Russian nationals. Supposedly, it transferred crypto for 8 ransomware variants, and 40% of the known transaction history is illegal or to people that are in pursuit of illegal aims, supposedly $370 million. They specifically listed 25 Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Tether addresses with $934 million in assets that are specifically listed on that SDN list.
That's a lot of crime.
That's a lot of crime.
That crime doesn't pay. Complete
it's
fallacy.
Wrong. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I think well, that
being,
I think
being a criminal and being stupid—that's what doesn't pay.
Yeah. So there's a blockchain analysis company called Chain Analysis that says that that exchange had received at least $160 million in Bitcoin from various known bad people.
So I assume that means that's their fee. They've gotten $160 million in fees from this endeavor is the way that I read that.
That does make sense because there's no other reason for the exchange to have received that because the exchange isn't... Although the exchange may be just holding the
Well, they facilitate
crypto.
Cryptocurrencies and fiat, so...
Yeah, I actually had to look that up. I was like, so what specifically does an exchange do? And it allows you to buy and sell the crypto, although it does hold it. It says hold some amount of crypto so that there's something for you to buy and for you to sell.
They have to control the wallet in order to facilitate the transactions, but you could take it out of the wallet and it'll put it into your own wallet offline.
Which is what you should do because these exchanges keep getting hacked and people keep losing.
Yeah,
crypto.
Just look up Mt. Gox, and that is all you will need to know about cryptocurrency exchanges and the risks therein.
So there's a couple interesting discussion points here. And I know that this is not directly relatable to some companies, but this may be relevant to you in the future if you get ransomware. But the penalty for violating sending something on to someone on this SDN list is a fine ranging up to a few million dollars. That's kind of chump change for a lot of companies. I can see a lot of companies simply adding this to the cost of doing business where ransomware gets you.
They just add that to the ransomware fee. So if the ransomware guys are asking for $4 million, you just say, this is going to cost us $6 million.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm not sure if this is true or not, but this seems very similar or maybe exactly the same as how the government goes after, rather than going after the people that are making money off drugs, they're going after the banks that are laundering the drug money.
It's the same concept, I would say.
Yeah.
Most of the sanctioned people list, that's mostly used for foreign policy aims. Sanctioned terrorists, sanctioned governments they don't like, sanctioned individuals they don't like.
Oh, so they're not putting banks on that list. They're putting individuals on the list and telling the banks not to do business with them. Banks and everybody else.
They put organizations on there as well.
So this is weird that they're putting an exchange on there. That is, although they did list 25 specific addresses. That seems a waste to put 25 specific addresses. Not that hard to spin up a new cryptocurrency address.
Because it's like putting
an email on there.
Because what they do is they just send that to a different address, take everything out and send it to a different address.
Well, all right. So that makes sense on why they'd pick the exchange, because the exchange might be a little bit harder to, like, we're going up the pyramid of pain for cryptocurrency. Yeah, the address is super easy to change. The exchange is a little harder to change, but probably not really. It's just another account somewhere else. So this is like blocking IP addresses for a cryptocurrency.
That would be a good analogy.
Interesting. So apparently the OFAC does allow transactions with the sanctioned entity on a case-by-case basis. And this kind of, I feel like this goes with an article we saw several weeks ago where the government was trying to tell all the ransomware people to come talk to them first before you pay, and you had to coordinate your payment through the government.
Actually, it's that article from the stooge at the Brookings Institute from the Lawfare blog.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was talking about banning ransomware payments, remember?
Oh, that's it. Okay.
It's almost the exact same concept.
Oh, interesting. So somebody at the Oval Office must have read that.
Maybe. It wasn't foreign policy.
Yeah. So they do explicitly state in the article that if you proactively notify the government, it may minimize the penalties you pay.
Yeah, this makes no sense to me. Hey, you can't do this thing, but if you come to us and say you're going to do that thing, then maybe you can do that thing that we told you not to do, but we're going to charge you less of a penalty if you do that thing that we told you not to do.
Isn't that normally the opposite for criminal cases? Because now it's premeditated.
Yeah, exactly. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, that concept. Because it almost seems we're going to do this not to actually stop people from paying ransom, but to give us information on who's paying ransom. It's like a data collection point is almost what it sounds like.
Interesting. Yeah, like just a forcing mechanism to make you go tell the government, which makes sense because we don't really have a good set of statistics on ransomware and other cybercrime because most companies hide it. But we'll talk about the difficulty of collecting statistics on people's behavior in the next article. So what happens to the legitimate holdings on that exchange? And are there any? I assume there's got to be some amount of legitimate holdings on there, but I guess there could not be.
It seems unlikely that it would be 100% criminal.
Yeah.
Because it's not like they would turn away business from a private, just a regular Joe.
A regular Joe doesn't be like, no, you don't want a bank here. You don't want to store your stuff here. But no, I do. I really do. Yeah, no. Because if anything, they want legitimate users to help shield them because legitimate users will throw a fuss. Like criminal users are just going to shrug and, you know, move their cryptocurrency elsewhere and pick a different one. But legitimate users are going to be like, no, I use this bank, or I'm using bank, but it's not actually a bank. I get that.
All right. I use this exchange.
Yeah, so. I use this exchange. Why are you blocking me from using this exchange? I got my $300 in Bitcoin on this exchange, damn it.
Yeah, oh, but the government doesn't care about anybody who's only got $300.
No, you're right. It's only when somebody with $1 billion in Bitcoin gets on there, and then they'll find an exception real fast.
Yeah. It takes at least $10,000 to bribe to pay for a congressman. So
yeah. So is this going to be a danger going forward for any exchange? I imagine that going forward, criminals may be like, all right, so what's a mostly legitimate exchange? So that, again, we're hiding in the noise, although with the blockchain and with the ledger, you can't hide for anybody that's really looking. But to try and make it more difficult for the government to try and shut down the exchange.
Yeah, then they just have to figure out some other mechanism to do it. Because I think what they're going to end up doing is pressuring the exchanges to act more like banks, where, you know, banks currently have what they call know your customer laws.
Yeah, we just had to do that recently. We opened up an account for my son and had to provide like a passport and just all kinds of crazy information to open an account.
Yeah, so they're probably going to start cracking down on exchanges for similar types of things. But the difficulty there is, it's easy for at least the U.S. government to do these know your customer laws in the United States, but crypto knows no boundary. And they can't really force that kind of thing on all international exchanges. I just don't think it's feasible.
Yeah, but if they start putting all the exchanges in other countries on this SDN list, it's going to create a real nasty mess of exchanges you can and can't use.
Yeah. Imagine that. The government creating a mess. Unbelievable. First time for everything.
Gotcha. So the other thing I was thinking about is crypto exchanges aren't really necessary to receive crypto payments. You can just send it directly to a wallet. I just find it really weird that they're targeting the exchange. But again, like that goes back to they're looking for the closest thing they can find to a bank probably.
Yeah, really all it's doing is it's making it a little bit more challenging to do it. Because you would send your crypto to this wallet. They could take that wallet, transfer to another wallet outside of the exchange, and then use that wallet to go to an exchange and then cash out, which is what they're doing anyway. So the government sanctions the closest exchange, but the attackers would just move farther back in that five or six steps or whatever and do the exchange later. Now, this goes back to what we've talked about numerous times before. This is not going to solve the problem. This is like the government fighting the war on drugs. They're doing it at the wrong point in the chain.
Yeah. They should legalize it and tax it. That's how you win the war on drugs. Work for ransomware, though.
I don't think, really, that's not the way you win the war on drugs. You actually find out why people think their lives are so shitty, they need to drug themselves in order to get away from it.
Oh, that's fair.
But it certainly will reduce the harm and the violence by legalizing the drugs.
You know what though? Let's go back to my solution for ransomware. Let's legalize and tax it.
I'm not necessarily on board with that. What we've talked about before is the operating system vendors need to fix this problem. And what I think would fix this in XPRIZE. So they had XPRIZE for
first commercial company to space, right?
Yep. Space, autonomous vehicles. They had one for actually automated attack and defend. Usually it's only like $1 million, but I think you could raise that up. I think this is enough of a scourge that it would be worth creating an XPRIZE for $10, $20 million for someone to solve this at the operating system. Mm-hmm. For someone to solve this at the operating system level, and you just come up with criteria for this, saying it's got to be done at the operating system, it's got to be free, and it's got to be able to be retrofitted into operating systems that have been produced in the last 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, because if you'd only did it going forward on like Windows 11, it'd be a decade before, and it actually never make it out everywhere. So Windows XP boxes on there 10 years, 20 years.
And I think that's how we solve this problem. Mm. Incentivize people to solve it. Actually, good programmers.
Incentivize them not to make ransomware, but instead to fix the problem.
Right. And when I say good, I don't mean in the sense of good and bad, but skilled.
Yeah.
Because maybe even the ransomware crews would be like, hey, this would be just a giant payout and we're done or something like that. But it doesn't really matter. I don't care who does it as long as this problem gets solved. And I think you have to do it at the operating system. This is just a band-aid. The attacker is going to shift their stuff around and it's not going to solve anything. All that does is even in the article, it says this is going to send a harsh message to victims. In any other crime, do you have to send a harsh message to the victim? Rape, robbery, murder, whatever. You don't send the message to the victims.
Not supposed to, at least.
It's just it's a bad way to go about it. It's wrong thinking, in my opinion.
I tell you what, while you're at the company level, while you're waiting for somebody to get off their butt and fix this for good, there are a couple things you can do about it. We reviewed the DBIR, which we'll talk about next week, but what it found was the big things there is getting rid of your open RDP SSH. A lot of ransomware is spread via doing credential stuffing attacks on RDP SSH on the internet. Use complex credentials that aren't shared anywhere. Use multi-factor authentication. Upgrade your antivirus and phishing, your mail protection products to modern products. Social engineering phishing training. Those will take care of 80%+ of your problems. And we'll talk more about ransomware in the DBIR next week. But if you can get that stuff done, that solves a lot of your issues.
Yeah. And if you do get hit, you are ransomware and one of these companies are involved, it would behoove you to have this idea considered ahead when you're doing your plan about what do you do if this happens, you get ransomware by a company who's on the sanction list, what's your plan? And ensure you're prepared for that. But the last article that we have to talk about today, is it okay to use stolen data? What if it's scientific research in the public interest? This comes to us from our friends at The Register.
We love The Register.
I do look at The Register quite a bit.
It's very not snarky, actually. I'm a little disappointed.
Yeah. Guy must be new. But a lot of scientists want to use the hack data in studies because just the volume of data that's out there, it gives them a large data set to actually do some statistical analysis on this information.
Well, it's not just statistical analysis. This is the fact that this is information that people don't self-disclose. As an example, the Ashley Madison stuff, you can ask people that are cheating all day long if they're cheating, and an awful lot of them are going to lie to you, unless part of their cheating is that they want to get caught.
Right. So basically you're saying it's data that people generally can't get a hold of.
Yeah, it's stuff that I think people are just more honest about because they don't think that it's going to be revealed.
Even though they willingly gave it up in the first place to someone at some point.
Yeah. And I think one of the things to take out of that, just this is an aside, is basically anything that you give a third-party company will eventually one day be revealed. No matter how secret you think your PMs are on your Facebook, eventually they're going to come out.
No,
but that's an aside. Yeah.
They say, if you want to keep something secret, don't tell anybody else. Because once you do, it's not a secret.
Two people can keep a secret if one of them's dead.
Right.
That should not be taken as encouragement of murder.
No, but if you ask Captain Flint, that's the best way to do it. But so the idea is that is research that uses hacked data or data of unethical origin, is that unethical also, even though it is lawful to do it? So the article, which actually goes to this report, suggests that there are six ethical and procedural requirements that should be addressed before you use the stolen and leaked data. So the first thing to consider is it unique or can this data be acquired ethically somewhere else?
Yeah, and that's what I'm seeing for things like the Panama Papers, and the Ashley Madison leak, and the recent leak of taxes and wealth documents from the IRS. Like, those are the sorts of things that you just cannot get. People are not going to give you an honest answer when you ask them, or they're going to blow you off. You can't go to a company and say, hey, I want to see your secret books. The ones are go to wealthy people and say, tell me how you're avoiding taxes. Like, those are things that you just cannot get without leaked data, unfortunately.
Right. Because if it's illegal, then, you're not going to get that data set anywhere other than through another illegal means. A second point, is the intended research of high social value? That's a really good question to answer right there, obviously.
Yeah, I was thinking of the Ashley Madison stuff. Of course, we want to know how many silly people are cheating. And then it's like, it was super important how Ashley Madison data was like 90% dudes and 10% women.
Oh, 10% higher than I thought. I thought it was like 90% dudes, 9% bots, and 1% women. Or maybe one woman.
That would not surprise me.
Yeah, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find any researcher that's going to say, of course my research is high social value, so I'm not going to do this. So I think that question is almost going to be defaulted to yes, regardless of who the researcher is. Third point is, are the users personally identifiable? You know, and if you can identify them, the researcher should try to obtain explicit informed consent from these individuals. So if you have a hack data set of 10,000 people, make sure you send out those letters.
Yeah, that's going to work out real well.
Yeah. I'm sure you get a high number of respondents there.
Oh, yeah. I was just looking. Ashley Madison is saying they have 60 million people now.
Holy cow. That's
ridiculous. They said people are still signing up and still joining.
That's interesting, though, because I can't remember last time I heard or saw an Ashley Madison ad, whereas before the breach, I used to see them with fairly regularly. Yeah. So it's like the breach could have been the greatest thing to happen to their advertisement. Anyway, if the personally identifiable information, or if there is personally identifiable information, then the research should only go forward if the risk is minimal and the benefits obvious. Yet again, another default question there for the researcher to answer. Next one is, clearly state where the data was obtained from. and that the data was obtained without user's consent. And what you did to protect the privacy of the individuals whose data is in there. And lastly, use review boards to review the ethics of the study.
Which I thought, frankly, review boards were always doing that personally, but I guess I'm not doing research in a college environment.
Right. You would think any research that has this kind of data in it would have to go through an ethics review board. And then there's secondary harm, which should be considered as harm not from the crime, but from how institutions deal with the crime.
Hey, you're asking about the Ashley Madison stuff. So Ashley Madison had 5.5 million female accounts, which is actually 16% of the accounts on there out of the 32 million were female. But the number of females who actually checked their inboxes on Ashley Madison, that's what they're using as a proxy for real accounts versus bot accounts, was 1,492. 0.0073% of Ashley Madison's users. So in comparison, over 20 million male customers out of the 27 million male customers had checked their inbox.
Yeah. See, I told you, less than 1%.
Oh, yeah. That is shocking. I knew it was going to be wildly out of, but wow. Like the number of dudes looking for women on Ashley Madison versus the actual 1,500 actual women. Guess they had their pick.
Yeah, those are good odds.
It's just like Tinder.
So that scene, the secondary harm seems very difficult to try and consciously mitigate.
Now, yeah, that requires that. I don't think, generally speaking, legally, we don't really look at secondary harm because it's so hard to do. Like, and so hard to figure out, like, who are the people that are harmed by the actions taken against the criminal. I don't know.
But what seems like an easy answer to this really isn't, which is to anonymize the data, which is actually easier said than done. So there'd be a link in the show notes to a study that found that it does not take that many data points to de-anonymize data. So the study found that with 99.98% accuracy, you could re-identify individuals using only 15 attributes. But I really think what this kind of boils down to is, what's the output of whatever the study it is that you're going to do? Is your output going to be trends, percentages, numbers, counts? And really, if you do this study, if you don't if it does not require to be reproducible or require scientific peer review, then it's the output is not really going to be that damaging to whatever information that you're studying.
Yeah, especially not if you're re-releasing the information, like the original information in a new venue.
Yeah, because if you've taken, it's almost like a hash. You can't spit out the data if you're only doing the percentages or numbers that the data was based off, or that those percentages are based off that data. So if that's the case, then the question would be, are you going to use the data for good or evil? Because the data is already out there. Because this goes back to what we were talking about before, that the myth of personally owned data, or the myth of personal data ownership. You don't really own your data. Whoever you give that data to is who owns it. So it's going to be very difficult for anybody to get a handle on the protection of that data once you had a breach or whatever.
Yeah, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier. As soon as you tell somebody about something at all, it's eventually going to come out. May not be this year, may not be next year, may not even be in 10 years, but at some point, someone's going to break into it, or someone's going to decide it's so old that it's no longer secret and they're going to release it for other seemingly benign purposes.
Yeah, and the example that they used in the article was the Nazis and then the space program. You know, they produced this horrible data, or they produced this good data using horrible methodologies. But now that the data is produced, is it ethical to use that data for a good purpose? This is a very similar question. But the question boils down to, if you're in this field of doing scientific research, the question is, are you going to use that data or not? And are those six recommendations, or what they call six requirements, is following that really going to get you get the outcome that everybody's expecting to make this work ethical?
Who cares if it's ethical? Is it going to get you all those mentions? Wait, what are they called in literature?
Grants.
Citations.
They don't want citations, they want grants. Is this going to get you grant money or not?
Yeah. All right. That looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Psych on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.